Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Deborah Becker. In for Robin Young, it's Here and Now. President George Bush is pledging $50 million in direct aid to the Palestinian Authority after meeting with Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas today. This is the first time that the two leaders have met since Abbas was elected president in January. The financial support could help Abbas shore up support at home, where he's facing parliamentary elections this year. Both Presidents Bush and Abbas emphasized that this is the time to move forward on the peace process.
People of the Middle East have endured a long period of challenge, and now we have reached a moment of hope. Leaders from around the world have made a moral commitment. We will not stand by as another generation in the Holy Land grows up in an atmosphere of violence and hopelessness.
Time is becoming our greatest enemy. We should end this conflict before it is too late. We are extending our hands to the Israeli people in good intention. We are saying that peace and dialogue and the recognition of the other side's rights is what will create a good neighborhood.
Joining us on the line from Washington, D.C. is David Makovsky, Senior Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Welcome, David.
Hi, good to be with you.
As we said, President Bush pledged direct aid to the Palestinian Authority today to use for housing and other infrastructure projects. How significant is that to Abbas in terms of his being able to gain support at home?
I think it's very important because it's clear that this is direct aid. The congressional funding to support the Palestinians was through what we call an NGO, non-governmental aid, or direct U.S. assistance, but not to the authority. And I think it is an important kind of shot in the arm and a sign of confidence that we are in a different phase than we were during the Arafat period, that there's a new page, a chance for a new chapter. And it comes at a key moment at this juncture because later this summer there will be an election of Abbas versus Hamas for the first time. The Abbas party, Fatah versus Hamas, and I think it's a sign to say when we take the steps against nonviolence, the world is going to support us. And so I think it was important the president did what he did, and he also called on the Arab oil states where the price of oil has doubled in the last couple of years and urged them to do much more to help the Abbas government.
And so what is Washington expecting in return?
I think that they want a continuation of the calm, no suicide bombs, really condition the societal landscape in the direction that Abbas has, saying that violence is counterproductive to the political aspirations of the Palestinians. I think that is critical, and I think their hope is that he will coordinate the Gaza pullout with Israel, improve security cooperation, and lead to a more peaceful future for these two peoples who have suffered so much.
Mm-hmm. Some U.S. lawmakers have expressed concerns about direct aid, citing alleged corruption among Palestinian officials and whatnot. How likely is it, do you think, that Congress will sign on?
Well, I think in this case, the $50 million, it seems to me, comes from the $55 million that was in the pipeline until now and was frozen when three American contractors were killed in Gaza, and Yasser Arafat refused to investigate it. So this is money, in my view, that's kind of old money that's been appropriated but never really implemented. And basically, it seems to me that the president is lifting the freeze and saying, we know that you're different than Arafat, and we know that your finance minister, Salam Fayyad, who worked at the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, for the last 20 years, he's trying to clean up the books. And things aren't maybe perfect, but compared to the Arafat era, we're in a totally different place, and we want a recognition of that. And I think it's an important thing. It's something Fayyad has been here in Washington trying to get. And so I think for the Palestinians, it's symbolic as well.
There were also strong calls to Israel today to stop settlement expansion and whatnot. How do you think that's going to affect things with the Israelis?
Well, I'm not sure because, frankly, Israel is totally focused on disengagement, of pulling, not just freezing settlements, but really pulling the settlers out of Gaza. It is going to be gut-wrenching for the Israelis. It's Sharon, who is the patron of the settlement movement, is seen by the settler movement as a traitor to the cause. There's going to be a lot of civil disobedience in Gaza this summer. The Shin Bet says there's 200 Israeli Jews who want to kill Sharon. His party is divided. My guess is that Sharon for the next few months is going to focus almost exclusively on getting out of Gaza and taking on these 8,000 people. So that's where I think his focus is going to be.
Mm-hmm. And what about the Hamas issue? You brought it up earlier, but President Bush has said he wants militant groups dismantled. He did mention it during the press conference today. And yet Mahmoud Abbas is working with Hamas and has to at some point. So how is that line sort of going to be walked in this case?
Well, I think you're asking a very good question. I mean, this is, we're in new territory we've never been in, is Hamas contesting an election. Abbas is making a gamble that he can co-opt them by bringing them in the system and moderating them over time. I know some Palestinians have kind of likened him to Shazli Ben Jadid, the head of Algeria, who tried that with the Islamists, and they beat him in the election. I think that basically it's a gamble. And what's different here is that this is unlike the other Islamist groups who are running in elections. These guys are not putting down their weapons. And that makes this very difficult. But it also creates a sense of urgency around the world and Washington, in Europe and the Arab states, to help Abbas to get money on the ground quickly so Abbas could tell his people, I went for nonviolence,
David,
and it pays off.
Okay, David Makovsky, Senior Fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy. Thanks very much.
Thank you. All the best.
Yesterday on Here and Now, we spoke with a retired Air Force general and a defense analyst about government plans to seize the military high ground that is space using satellites and spacecraft armed with killer laser and radio beams and huge spikes called rods from God. It's an ultra-modern view of war and of American military supremacy. According to Andrew Bacevich, it's just one more example of an infatuation with military might that he thinks is dangerous. Bacevich heads the Center for International Relations at Boston University, and he's author of the book The New American Militarism. Robin Young recently asked him how he came to fear America's romance with war.
You know, as somebody who was, and I guess in some senses still sees himself as a cold warrior, I once rejected out of hand the left's view of foreign policy. And the left's view of foreign policy, and this is really the far left, is that U.S. foreign policy is inherently expansionistic, and that we have come to believe as a people, certainly political elites, Republicans and Democrats alike, have come to believe that we have to exercise global influence and to shape the world in particular ways if we are going to sustain the American way of life.
You write, in the 90s, America's marriage of militaristic cast of mind with utopian ends, which you just described, has established itself as the distinguishing element of contemporary U.S. policy. Your book examines the origins of this union, this marriage, and proposes its annulment. What do you mean by that?
The part that's not new really is the utopianism. I mean, from before the founding of the Republic, we Americans saw ourselves as engaged in an experiment whereby we were going to become the city on the hill. We had some kind of a larger providential mission. That's part of who we are, and it's never going to go away. The piece that's new, my book tries to argue, is that we now have come to believe, since the end of the Cold War, we have come to believe that through the aggressive use of American military power, by perpetuating power and being willing to apply power, that that's the way to accomplish that larger purpose. That's the dangerous piece.
Why? Why is it dangerous?
Well, it's dangerous, I think, because there is a long history that says that countries that embrace militarism come to bad ends. And we don't have to look very far back into the history of the 20th century to see examples of that.
Bad ends economically.
And militarily. That, right. To bet on power is to run afoul of all kinds of problems. I mean, look at the Germans and look at the Japanese. Not for a second am I implying that American militarism is like German militarism. I'm simply saying that militarism is a recipe for disaster. But beyond that, this reflects, I think, a fundamental turning away from our founding ideals. I mean, the people who came to the new world intended that this world be genuinely new. They meant to turn away from an old world that they believe was defined and, in a sense, ruined by the competition for power and the emphasis on war. And at the very center, I think, of our effort to create a new world was a skepticism about war and military power that was present among Americans. It was hardwired into Americans for probably the first two centuries of our existence. And that's now gone away.
In fact, you quote James Madison speaking in 1795. Can you remember the quote offhand, or should I help you with it? Well, he says, "Of all the enemies of public liberty, war is perhaps the most to be dreaded because it comprises and develops the germ of every other. War is the parent of armies. From these proceed debts and taxes. And armies, debts, and taxes are the known instruments for bringing the many under the domination of the few."
And see, I'd emphasize that was not some sort of unusual or idiosyncratic opinion. That was the common wisdom of the founders. And I'd also want to emphasize that was a common wisdom that carried down through subsequent generations. You know, as recently as President Eisenhower's term as president, you know, his final public act in his farewell address to the American people was to issue this warning about what he called a military-industrial complex. Well, if you go back and read that speech, and it's a speech that deserves to be read again today, it's not simply a warning about defense industries. It's a warning that says, yes, perhaps circumstance calls upon us to maintain a great military establishment, as it did during the Cold War. But, he said, be wary. Mm. This establishment can, if not used properly, can become a threat to our liberty, and it is incumbent upon citizens, he said, to be informed and to be watchful.
But, Andrew Bacevich, as you well know, the question that comes up right about now in this discussion is, yes, but this is post-9/11. Yet you write, 9/11 really has nothing to do with what has happened with the U.S. view of the military.
I hope I don't say that it has nothing to do, but the story I try to tell, the story of this growing infatuation with military power, is something that it's an infatuation that began well before 9/11. And the story I try to tell is one that suggests that American militarism really is an unintended consequence of Vietnam. I mean, my sense of that chapter in our history is that then and since, there were tens of millions of Americans who viewed the 60s as a disaster. Who said, this is when we lost our way. This is when we suffered humiliation and defeat and lost our self-confidence. And those Americans, their reaction to the 60s included the notion that through the revival of American military power, we can reverse the verdict of the 1960s. They succeeded in rebuilding the American military establishment by the Reagan era, but that project became perverted and gave birth to the notion that somehow by perpetuating military supremacy, that somehow we would be better able to fulfill our purposes. And I question that.
That's Andrew Bacevich, author of the book The New American Militarism. There's more coming up here and now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. Andrew Bacevich, former career military officer and current Boston University professor, says Americans have fallen in love with military force as a possible solution to the nation's challenges. Big mistake, says Bacevich, and one made by Democrats and Republicans alike. Here's more of Robin Young's conversation with Bacevich.
There is a strong literary or aesthetic tradition in America, going back at least to World War I, perhaps even in some senses to the Civil War, if you include Stephen Crane, but especially going back to World War I, you know, writers like Ernest Hemingway. And that aesthetic tradition said that, you know, war is brutality. You know, war is ugliness. Armies are repressive institutions. This was the aesthetic of war that came out of World War I and was affirmed in World War II, was affirmed certainly in Vietnam, and was in many respects challenged, and I think even arguably we could say was reversed in the 1980s, with a new pop culture depiction of warfare as now being transformed by technology and therefore having become much more antiseptic, precise, controllable, clean, and an area of human endeavor in which we Americans had a particular sort of gift. And Top Gun, which was the number one box office movie of the year when it came out, Top Gun is a perfect example of that. These are guys who never miss a meal, who are walking around in starched white uniforms and wearing these spiffy-looking leather jackets and riding motorcycles, and the only time they ever break a sweat is when they're playing volleyball.
Right. This is part of that romance you talk about and that marriage of optimism and the military. Well, with that in mind, yesterday we talked about the Air Force Space Command's plans to put defensive and offensive weapons in outer space, a weapon called Rods from God, that if it worked, and that's a big if apparently, would drop large super hard spikes on an enemy, basically slicing and dicing an area up, weapons that could respond within 45 minutes from anywhere around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Again, not a lot of discussion of blood or, you know, again, a very antiseptic approach.
Well, and not a lot of discussion, period. Reflecting, as it were, our own willingness to assent to these sorts of militarizing initiatives. So it's simply the willingness to defer to the chief executive that's striking. The second thing that's striking is the extent to which these are decisions made really in an undemocratic way. I mean, it's an issue that's studied within the executive branch by institutions that may have some interest, in the Air Force, for example, resulting in what is, in a sense, an executive decision by the president, with the expectation that everybody else, the Congress, goes along with it, rather than being openly and publicly debated on the merits. I'm willing to be persuaded that the weaponization of space could be necessary, but I'd like to see the arguments made to demonstrate that case, because it's not patently obvious that the weaponization of space is indeed in our interest or in the interests of the rest of the world. If we're talking about permanently positioning weapons in space, then we are crossing a great big bright red line, and we just ought to know what we're about before we commit as a nation to doing that.
Hmm. That brings me back to a question I've been thinking about as we speak. I want to make sure that we are clear about your position. Again, I asked you, you know, who are you? Where do you come from? Because that seems to be important to people now. Mm-hmm. And maybe it's wrong, you know. Is he from the left? Is he from the right? As you've explained, you were very much a conservative who was in Vietnam, mm-hmm. and are very conservative still in a lot of cultural issues. My question is, when you say, and I'm going to borrow a line I read of your writing, mm-hmm. you talk about leaning away from war. Mm-hmm. Leaning towards what?
Well, leaning away from war. Let me try to give a broader answer to the question. I mean, if anybody imagines that this book is a pacifist track, a call for disarmament, an attack on soldiers, an anti-American, you know, a lefty professor attacking America. It's none of those things. I'm not in favor of a weak America. I'm in favor of a strong America, but I'm also in favor of a wise America, wise policies. So leaning away from war means to return to our longstanding tradition of viewing force as an instrument of last resort. You know, the Bush administration's doctrine of preventive war does not view war as a last resort. We are now in the business of waging wars of choice. You know, there are very few people listening to this broadcast who, if they got up tomorrow morning and read in their newspaper that the United States the previous night had attacked Iran, there are very few people who would be surprised. Some would approve it, some would disapprove of it, but we wouldn't be surprised, because we've come to expect that the United States initiates hostilities. I think that's foolish. So leaning away from war is to lean toward other instruments of policy.
Such as, because that's where...
Such as, I mean, my own sense is that in Washington, and this, I hope this doesn't sound unfair to Foreign Service officers, but my own sense in Washington is that the State Department has come to be viewed generally as a weak institution. You know, that if you really want to get something done, you give it to the Department of Defense. Mm. If you want something to sort of get chewed on and talked about, then you give it to the State Department. Well, I would argue that that's unacceptable. If we are a great power, we need to have an effective instrument of diplomacy. It is common knowledge that we are utterly bankrupt when it comes to public diplomacy. That is, telling our story to the world, of shaping an image so that we'll be seen in the eyes of the world the way we want to be seen. Well, we need to fix that.
Andrew Bacevich, the author of The New American Militarism, thank you so much for coming in to speak with us about it.
Oh, thank you very much.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, a photojournalist goes to Sudan on a humanitarian mission and gets arrested. That's tomorrow. Stay with us. There's more ahead, Here and Now. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. Last year's historic Boston Red Sox playoff series was marred by tragedy. An Emerson College student and Red Sox fan was killed while celebrating the team's victory with a crowd of revelers in Boston. 21-year-old Victoria Snellgrove was shot by Boston police with a pepper pellet gun after the Sox win over the New York Yankees in October. Now, the independent commission investigating the incident has released a report with some scathing criticism of Boston police and suggestions for how police departments across the country should use so-called less lethal weapons. The commission's Stern report is named after the panel's chair, former U.S. Attorney Donald Stern. He and Boston Police Commissioner Kathleen O'Toole came into our studios to talk about the report. Commission Chair Donald Stern, your panel formally met 5 times to review the shooting death of Victoria Snellgrove in October. And in summary, your report found problems with several things: training, bad communication, no policies on the use of so-called less lethal weapons. I'm wondering, what was most significant? Was there a single event or a series of events that were most significant that contributed to the problem?
I think probably the most significant thing, and the Boston Police Department, by the way, is not alone in this failing, is that the department had not created use-of-force policy that was tailored to the particular weapon. In other words, there were general use-of-force policies, but no one had really focused on this particular weapon. Now, the follow-up problem was there wasn't training on the weapon as to how it should be used. I think the second thing that struck us, and I frankly was a little bit of surprised at this when I got into this area, is really a more national problem, a broader problem, and that is that there is no uniform testing or certifications of these kind of weapons across the board for departments, wherever they might be.
Another thing that struck me, it mentions that Boston police had crowd control plans in place before and learned lessons from other events such as the Super Bowl and the Democratic National Convention, but it says senior police commanders had strong views about those lessons that were not consistent. What does that mean?
For reasons that are not altogether clear, the planning for that particular event, for the 7th game of the American League championship game, just had some problems. And part of it was miscommunication. Part of it was, I think, sort of bearing down and coming up with a precise plan for the events that evening. And it's clear that they learned from those mistakes. And we recommend that apart from the written plan, which is important, and the rules of engagement need to be clearly spelled out, we recommend that there be tabletop exercises and the kind of practical back and forth in communication, which we think will improve the situation.
Boston Police Commissioner Kathleen O'Toole, let's address first the failure of the department that Mr. Stern mentions.
Yes, it was a failure of the department. And in the hours after Victoria Snellgrove's tragic death, on behalf of the department, I took full responsibility. I think Mr. Stern is right that the Boston Police Department is not unlike most major city police departments today. We hope to go to the National Institute of Justice and other federal organizations looking for some help in the development of certification and training policies that will not only benefit Boston, but benefit other jurisdictions as well.
How does Mr. Stern's report fit in with the internal investigation that's going on?
The internal investigators agree in every respect with Mr. Stern's report. In fact, it was Mr. Stern's report was based in large part on the investigations and the interviews conducted by the Boston Police Internal Affairs Unit and the Boston Police Homicide Unit. You know, again, mistakes were made. Two of our commanders made mistakes during the course of the preparation of this event and during the night of the tragedy.
I'm talking about Deputy Superintendent
Bob O'Toole and Superintendent James Claiborne. Superintendent Claiborne was responsible for the planning of this event and was the officer in charge the night of the event. Deputy Superintendent O'Toole was in the field that evening, and, you know, both of them made some mistakes. And sure, they'll be held accountable for those mistakes, but they're two individuals that have contributed very significantly in a positive way in other events such as the DNC.
So although Deputy Superintendent O'Toole has retired, and we should say no relation to you, although he has retired, there will be further disciplinary action?
We have filed disciplinary charges. If his retirement becomes effective prior to the disciplinary hearings, then we have no jurisdiction over him. But, you know, I would suggest that, you know, Deputy Superintendent O'Toole has paid a very significant price. And these officers, I have to say, are devastated by this tragedy. You know, they will be held accountable, but they have to live with this for the rest of their lives, too.
And Donald Stern, let's go back to you for a moment. Can you tell me, what does the report say about the use of these weapons? You mentioned it briefly at the top, but is there a recommendation about what should be done even on a national level to deal with this so-called less than lethal weapons?
Well, let me first say that I think, again, not just in Boston, but nationally, there is a problem with the technology outstripping the ability, at least demonstrated so far, of law enforcement agencies to incorporate that technology into the normal training and implementation process. We didn't want to discourage the development of less lethal weapons. They can save civilian lives. They can save police officer lives. So we urge caution, not out-and-out abandonment of less lethal weapons. But we do think that a couple of things need to happen. One, greater scrutiny before you buy them, which includes testing and a written protocol of how you do it. Number two, a greater awareness of the dangers. Less lethal does not mean non-lethal. Use of force policies geared and tailored to each weapon, particularly when it comes to crowd control. More thorough training. Each police department is going to have to do its own training, but hopefully can do so with the backdrop and with the help of some national standards, some national guidance, so that if you're the police department in Boston or you're a small police department in Kansas, you've got some benchmarks, you've got some templates.
You also mentioned a civilian review board
to
look at officers' behavior in situations like this. Can you explain that a little bit?
What we recommend is, apart from other plans that I know the commissioner has for a broader input of civilians in the department's efforts, we recommend that there be a civilian police review process, which looks not only at civilian injuries with less lethal weapons, but looks at officer injuries.
So what happens with these recommendations then? You review them and see? I mean, how are you going to implement them?
I have said that we are embracing the recommendations in their entirety and have appointed two superintendents who will work with a broader committee to implement all of the recommendations, not only the recommendations that Mr. Stern's group made, but the recommendations that our own internal investigators presented as well. And I have to say that, sure, there are concerns about the officers involved. I'm concerned about them. You know, sometimes people forget that police officers are human beings. And, you know, these police officers have been deeply affected by this. In the hours after the tragedy, I was with police officers who were crying uncontrollably, and they have to live with this for the rest of their lives. It's clear that nobody intended to hurt or kill Victoria Snellgrove on the night of this horrible tragedy. It's also clear that they had no idea of the potential lethality of this particular device. So it's a tragedy in many respects, first and foremost for the Snellgrove family, but it's also a tragedy for the officers involved.
Boston Police Commissioner Kathleen O'Toole and former U.S. Attorney Donald Stern, who chaired the commission investigating the Boston Police shooting deaths of Victoria Snellgrove. You're listening to Here and Now. All charges have been dropped against a U.S. Marine who faced the death penalty for killing two suspected insurgents in Iraq. A Marine general has decided to stop the prosecution of Lieutenant Ilario Pantano, a former Wall Street trader and film executive who rejoined the Marines after September 11th. He was accused of repeatedly shooting the two Iraqis during a raid last year and hanging a sign over them that read, "No better friend, no worse enemy," a Marine slogan. Joining us on the line is John DeSantis. He's a senior writer for the Star News in Wilmington, North Carolina, where Lieutenant Pantano lives. John, Pantano's lawyer has said this case represents higher-up second-guessing soldiers in the field, but exactly why were the murder charges against him dropped?
The charges were ordered dropped this morning by Major General Richard Huck, who had also ordered the investigation into them. He said that he had looked at the evidence that was brought at a hearing last month at Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, and that after doing that, he felt that insufficient evidence existed to support the criminal charges.
Hmm. His case has been a big topic on conservative talk radios. Is there a lot of support for Pantano where you are?
A tremendous amount of support here in North Carolina among veterans groups and just plain folks. The defense certainly had presented their case prior to the military officially presenting theirs in this matter. People read stories, people heard things on the radio, and certainly had a lot to say about it.
Mm-hmm. Can you just remind us briefly of what the case involved? He was accused of shooting the two Iraqis, and what were the circumstances?
This happened last year near Mamadiah. Lieutenant Pantano and his platoon had gone to search a house that was believed to be an insurgent nest. While they were in the process of approaching the house, two men left the area in a white sedan. They were ordered to stop. Some shots were fired. They were searched. Their vehicle was searched. Weapons and some things were found in the house. At that point, Lieutenant Pantano had ordered the men who were handcuffed, unhandcuffed, and had them search their own vehicle to determine if there were any explosives. The rest of the Marines were inside the house searching. There were two Marines near Lieutenant Pantano, and he claimed that the two men, while they were searching their car, made a threatening move toward him, and he opened fire.
Mm-hmm. Apparently, also, the Marine General, who today said the charges would be dropped, also rejected all punishment for Pantano, yes?
That's correct. And when I spoke with some Marine Corps people at headquarters earlier today, they said that based on the totality, which included something that was not at the hearing, and that was autopsy results, the Marine Corps had finally taken possession of the bodies after the hearing, that he felt that Lieutenant Pantano's version of events was true.
Mm-hmm. And what could have happened to him? What disciplinary action could have been taken?
The charge that they were looking at as the top charge was premeditated murder, and that technically is punishable by death.
Mm-hmm. Did a lot of people speak on his behalf?
During the hearing, there were a number of people who had served under Lieutenant Pantano in Iraq, many of whom said that they would serve under him again in combat and would look forward to the prospect of doing so. Not the prospect of combat, but to serving under him if they were.
Mm-hmm. You've been covering this for a long time. What's your sense of what happened today?
I think, in looking at everything that we've seen, that the military justice system at this stage of proceedings did what it does. It's highly unusual for an Article 32 hearing, which is prior to a court-martial, to get quite this much exposure. And as the prosecutors have told us, as the Marine Corps has told us, and as the defense has told us, this is part of that process, which is looking at what evidence there is to see if it's warranted going forward further. In this particular case, the general said that it was not, and
okay,
that the evidence was supported.
We're going to have to cut you off. John, thanks very much. John DeSantis is senior writer for the Star News in Wilmington, North Carolina. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Deborah Becker. It's Here and Now. When Rachel Dwoskin graduated from college in 1994, she decided to do something a little different. She moved to Beijing, got a job with a PR firm, and soon became a soap opera star. As Jessie in the miniseries Foreign Babes in Beijing, Dwoskin played the stereotypical wild American girl who breaks up a Chinese man's marriage and gets him to marry her. It became a smash hit on Chinese TV, playing to an estimated 600 million viewers, and people started to confuse Dwoskin with her character. Dwoskin's new memoir, also titled Foreign Babes in Beijing, explores cross-cultural romance, a changing China, and whether the character Jessie and the real Rachel were alike after all. Dwoskin recently spoke with Here and Now's Robin Young.
How did it come about that you were in the soap opera?
Actually, it was very random. I was at a party in a expat's hutong, or Sihe Yuar, in a courtyard-style house owned by an expatriate.
And we should say you had some classroom Chinese.
I had classroom Chinese, but I was struggling.
Yeah.
And I was at a party, and this Chinese guy saw me, and he said, "You're white. Do you want to be in my friend's soap opera?" And I said, "No." I had a job, and I was working 24 hours a day. And then my job became more and more oppressive for me, and so I agreed to go see the studio with him. And once I checked out the studio, I wanted to see more.
Your book begins as you're right in the middle of this, and it seems right in the middle of realizing, what have I gotten myself into? Could you just explain a little bit about the plot, and then we'll hear some of your written reflections on it?
Sure. The plot of Foreign Babes in Beijing is true to a sort of yin-yang sensibility, and it's also standard television fare. There's a good girl who's blonde and angelic and patient and loves China, and there's a brunette who's a vixen.
That's you.
That's me, of course. The girl with brown hair always gets cast as the bad girl. Both Jessie and Louisa fall in love with Chinese men. Louisa, being a good girl, falls in love with a young unmarried Chinese guy, and Jessie falls in love with his older married brother. But in the end of the show, we're both redeemed. It's a very happy ending. And Louisa stays in China and becomes a China hand and moves in with the family of her husband. And I take Tianming back to America.
Tianming
is her love.
Yeah.
And in a sense, it's the best case scenario to have one son stay in China and care for the parents and their dotage, and the other move west for a glistening global life.
Some Western critics thought that the show was anti-American propaganda. But you don't agree. Why?
Well, I think it's complicated. I think if you argue that something is propaganda, you have to ask what the final moral message is. And teenage girls and their grandmothers followed me down the street because they wanted to buy whatever Jessie was buying, whether it was a fake Prada purse or a container of fish paste. My life became a kind of surreal advertisement. And so Jessie was finally aspirational. And people loved her because she sacrifices everything for true love in the end of the script, and her true love is a Chinese man. And so it didn't impart a message of xenophobia or distrust of Western women or scorn. Nobody wanted to be Tianming's virtuous wife left at home. They wanted to be the liberated, tough, sassy, adoring vixen.
Well, it could be that if the producer's intent was to make this character anti-American, it didn't work.
I think the producer's intent was to make money.
Well, in this scene, you, in real life, playing Jessie, the slut, is having a scene with your love interest.
Right.
Okay.
Wang Ling played my love interest, Tianming. He was unstoppably macho, 6'2" and chiseled, designed by producers and personal trainers to turn the tables on Hollywood stereotypes of wimpy Chinese men. My role was to play the exotic, mysterious femme fatale, relieving Eastern women momentarily of that chore. Jointly, Wang Ling and I would establish a contemporary counterpoint to a tense historical reality that intercultural romances in China were primarily between Western men and Chinese women. There were 106.6 males for every 100 females in China in the 1990s, and no Chinese man liked to see beautiful marriage prospects plucked from the pool. Chinese producers would not have dared show a Chinese woman seducing a Western man on TV. It was safer to depict China penetrating the West.
So to speak.
So to speak, indeed.
Because the scene goes on and suddenly you're sort of naked and trying to get your director to understand that you were not that character. But then you start to explore in the book, well, maybe you were a little bit like Jessie, the character, and the Western stereotype. Tell me about that.
Well, one of the things that China gave me, in addition to perspective on China, was perspective on myself in the world and perspective on America in the world. And I think China's ideas about America were not always the same as mine. But in some ways, I finally came to think that they were ultimately more significant because more people held them. And because I did do things that reminded me of Jesse in the script. My landlord wanted to have dinner with me 5 nights a week, as an example. And I would say to her things like, well, I'm used to my Western customs, and so I can't have dinner with you 5 nights a week. Or the producers of Foreign Babes in Beijing gave out my address and telephone number to anyone who called the studio, which was a friendly gesture. People called, they wanted to meet me, and they would come to my house. That was a little bit out of my comfort zone. And so I kept saying things like, according to my Western customs, comma, which is very Jesse speak.
Those are the words they put into
your character.
It
was exactly the way Jesse would have spoken. Yeah. And, you know, then I fell in love with a Chinese guy. And
yes,
I
you
had
did.
A romance with him.
Oh, well, let's not just roll over that. He's the actor Zhao Zheng. Do you think you were just acting out Jesse's part, or
I tried very hard not to act out Jesse's part. This was the thing. I was very self-conscious about becoming Jesse. And in my life with Zhao Jun, I was very careful not to say cheesy things.
Like, and such as? Give me more what Jesse would
such
say.
Such as, I love you, what are we waiting for? This is one of my dialogue lines. Or, what is it with you Chinese guys? Can't you love anyone other than your wives? She was very aggressive. So I tried to be a little bit more demure, which doesn't come naturally to me.
Well, that's a caricature of Western women. It's the Chinese view, or at least the scriptwriter's view. But did you find there was a little bit of you that fit that caricature?
Of course. And I would argue that, in fact, these stereotypes are they're not born in the Chinese imagination. They're exports. Yeah. These stereotypes come from shows like Dallas. You know, Baywatch, as we speak, is being beamed all over Asia by satellite.
That's so sad.
And so the Chinese idea, well, it's sad and festive both. The Chinese idea about American women comes originally really from America. And Chinese people often said to me, you look like Whitney Houston, Brooke Shields, and Vivian Leigh were the most common ones I got, demonstrating to me that being American or looking American in a certain way or in a television way overrode characteristics that we might find distinguishing, such as being black or having blonde hair. Right?
Well, it's a delightful trip that you tell of. And now you're back here in the West. I guess that's my last question to you. How do you feel about Beijing today? I mean, how do you feel about your time there?
I feel a magnetic pull back to Beijing. And I like to live my life in between. I live in New York half the time, and I spend the summers and the winters and sometimes trips in the spring to Beijing. And Beijing is always changing. It's fabulously global and interesting and alive. It's a very lively city and a very sophisticated and layered city culturally. And I often describe the feeling I have when I come from Beijing back to the United States. It's a feeling of having been on a moving floor and then suddenly getting off. So I adore Beijing, in short.
Besides, when you come back here, you don't get to use lines like,
I love you, what are we waiting for?
Rachel Dwoskin, her new book is called Foreign Babes in Beijing, Behind the Scenes of a New China. Rachel, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. This is a bit of Chinese pop from the Hong Kong singer Wang Rong. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.